pretend we started, I think. We just actually have started 30 seconds ago. Ewan can cut something in and we'll be good to go. So this is episode 3 of the Comic Cast, which I have unilaterally subtitled The Crimson Butler. In homage to 30s pulp comics. Nothing crimson, nothing butlerish coming up, I think. We're going to have a chat about Jeff Gamet's adventures in Comic-Con in Denver. We're going to talk about some comic e-readers, and we're going to diss Dave Gibbons again for another week in a row, and we're going to do all this magical stuff in the presence of Paul Kirkle.
Hello.
And Jeff Gamet.
Hey.
And Kelly Gabont.
Hey, everybody.
So, from last week, we had a bit of a rough and tumble with comic superstar pen for hack Dave Gibbons. So, off the top of the hat, who is better than Dave Gibbons, Paul?
Everyone is better than Dave Gibbons. But if I had to pick the most artisty of artist comic book artists, I'd probably pick Dave McKean, who I love. I love Dave McKean artwork. I've never seen a picture of his that I didn't like. I've never seen a comic panel series of his that I didn't like. I've got the majority of his books, apart from the ones that I can't afford. Love Dave McKean. And when I teach graphic design, and now I teach next generation graphic design, because we're doing all the exciting tablet-y stuff, and all of the students know that the answer to every graphic design question that I ask, the first answer is Dave McKean.
So you're an easy class to pass, then?
Oh, blimey, they get every time they mention Dave McKean or Chin Chin Labs ice cream, bosh, that's 3 or 4% of their marks done straight away.
Awesome. Kelly, who's better than Dave Gibbons?
I'm looking for who the actual art is behind Sandman, because that's what I've been adoring this week. I've got 2 volumes of Absolute Sandman from the library, and so whoever is responsible for these, and I say that with a caveat, because my pick would be...
She's Googling.
I want to make sure I have the right name. Matthew Southworth is my current favorite, better than Dave Gibbons.
Okay, and Jeff...
And he's the artist behind Stumptown, which is the book I recommended last week.
Jeff?
I'm going indie. So I'm going with indie comic artist. Her name is Jessie Jordan, and I've known her for a few years now. And the project she's currently working on is called The Glass, and the website's theglasscomic.com. And it's just it's a fun art style, and it's really friendly and approachable, and I really like her art. So there you go. Independent comic artist Jessie Jordan is better than Dave Gibbons.
Excellent. And now it brings me great pleasure to introduce our special guest to episode 3 of the podcast, Dave Gibbons.
Come on.
Oh, I wish I could follow through with that. That would be so, so awesome.
You know, I would immediately go, "Hi, Dave. Great to meet you. So what have you done?
Lately.
What we know you.
No, just what have you done?
Yeah. What are you
Should
most proud
of? Your work?
So we last week we did some picks, and I think they were all awesome. I've certainly had a fantastic week because I've chewed right through Stumptown almost immediately, and I'm going through Chew at the moment. And I've read the first edition of Jeff's pick, which has popped meteorically out of my mind as I'm talking. It was the Matthew Miller one. What was what did you pick, Jeff?
Wanted by Mark Miller.
Mark Miller, yes, sorry. Yep. Yes, which is awesome, although I do think Mark Miller has a tendency to swear too much.
The dialogue in his work is very colourful.
Fruity. Yes.
Blue.
Yes.
Yes.
But Kelly...
colourful, I mean blue.
So I think, from my perspective, I think you won outright, because I do adore Stumptown. I think it's fantastic. And you've got a follow-up from that?
I do. A couple of things, actually. First is that I went and... So I have a Twitter client that notifies me whenever I say... whenever somebody, favorites something or retweets something that I've said. So last week, after we did the show, I had tweeted about how I loved it and how after you had talked about, you had thanked me for the pick because you enjoyed it. And so then I wrote how they can tell the hell out of a story. And I got a reply back from Matt Southworth, who said, that was lovely. And thank all this sort of stuff. And it was great. And then, so I went back and forth with him a little bit. And I said something about more Stumptown. Oh, and then he had put up a picture and said, like, would people be interested in buying one of these? And I said, I would if I had the cash for that. But maybe if you did a larger run of maybe a black and white print and those were, you know, numbered, maybe I'd totally buy one of those. So we started talking about art, about the art and about how I really liked Stumptown and how I picked him on this new comic podcast that I'm doing. And then he said he was looking forward to hearing my pick. And I said, here's what I didn't say that I should have said, which is I would like to be a comic book woman that you draw because you draw actual women and not comic book women. And he wrote back and said, I can probably get you into this one I'm working on, but it wouldn't be for a while yet.
Cool.
And I died.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
We'll be looking for the hair as we flick through the book.
Well, now I was going to say, you know, like it's I'm pretty animated anyway. So to officially have been animated would be very exciting for me. So there you go.
But she's the heroine. She takes a kicking, doesn't she?
She really does. And for me, that was kind of the cool thing about it was that it was she happened to be female and it wasn't watch this girl do stuff. And for me, that's the appeal of Stumptown.
Excellent. So
that's actually really cool because so many of the comics that I have seen where they put a woman in the lead role, it's guys that don't know how to write women characters. And so what they do is, excuse the expression, they put tits on a guy and that's the character.
And if they don't do that, they do the opposite extreme, which is, look how brave I am because I'm a girl and I'm going into this empty building or whatever. Mm. You know, look how novel it is that the girl's doing it. And so I really enjoy something that where it happens that she's a woman, but it's not like the most important piece of the story. Because that's the same thing with it's how I always describe Battlestar Galactica. Like the new one is that it's a good drama that happens to be set in space in a sci-fi sort of universe.
Sure.
And you know, but that's not like the point of the story. So those are the things that I'm looking for when I'm looking for a book is like, I don't want, you know, oh look, it's a big deal because, you know, because she's a girl or like how that whole back half of Ellen turned into watch the gay lady do something. Like, I'm not interested in that, you know, so do something else. What I am interested in is the plate full of stuff that just showed up on Andrew's desk.
My daughter's just delivered a curry to my desk.
This is getting worse and worse. That rage.
So,
seriously talk to my family about letting me down at this moment.
Kelly, that's the reason why I didn't like Galactica, the remake, at the beginning. I grew to love it at the end, or like series two, series three. But the miniseries, I watched it when it first came out, and I instantly disliked the idea that a Cylon had been turned into a tall, leggy blonde in high heels, having a sex scene with the Cylon red thing going up and down her spine. And I just thought, you've just taken something that had a really nice, the last vestige of humanity crawling through space, battling against robots that are destroying them bit by bit by bit. I loved that in the original. And then the remake just felt like it was, well, what are we going to do? Yeah, let's add sex into it. And the Cylons can be sexy, and that's what's new. And I hated that. And it grew to be brilliant.
Yeah.
But the miniseries... I hated the miniseries because of what you're talking about. Basically, mm-hmm. They thought, how can we update it? It's got to be with sex.
Yeah.
And that really irritated me about the beginning of it.
I must be so shallow because my thought was I want to be assimilated.
Your thought was awesome. They've updated it with sex.
Shallow,
closely
shallow.
Followed by, and while it was nice, thank God Dirk Benedict's not in it anymore.
No, he should have had a walk-on part. I felt very bad about that. I tell you what, Starbuck was a really great character. I liked her a lot. And I thought she was a good female character. But actually, a lot of the female characters in Galactica were great. Mm-hmm. It was just the beginning bit that I thought was awful. Or, you know, just the whole shallow blonde sex on legs thing. I just thought that feels like a real missed trick. And then, actually, they proved me wrong.
And what was also good about it was that, for the most part, it wasn't a hang-up that the women in the show were women, which is one of the things I liked about it. Mm. You know, like, they were in love with somebody and trying to do something, and they were motivated by the fact that they cared about these people. And that didn't matter that they were women, because if there had been a guy in that same situation who was doing something for someone that they cared about, it would have sort of come out the same, I guess. Mm. It's kind of hard to explain, but it totally wasn't about because Starbuck was a woman or because Boomer was a woman or any of those kind of things. And, like, one of my favorite characters in the entire series was Roslyn.
Mm. Yep.
Because she was just amazing. Yep. I mean, aside from execution, like, her arc throughout the story was just awesome. Yep. Like, you know, dropping somebody into that kind of situation and seeing how they react and seeing that she didn't do it flawlessly. For me, that was the best part.
Yeah. And actually, I thought Edward James Olmos was brilliant as a martyr, and I thought she was his equal in every way. And I liked that, because he was... Often you'll get a TV show which relies on the... And I don't watch CSI, but whoever the guy is in CSI who was the one with the beard that everyone sort of, like, rallied around all the time. But Grissom. You get the one Grissom character that is the one guy in all of these shows, and everyone rallies around him because he's the big wise one. And actually, Armada was great because it split it into two characters who were, you know, War and Peace, but equally good. And if Roslyn hadn't been good, it would have been terrible. Because it would have been War versus Peace.
That was a huge
and Peace is nobody in comparison to War. Because it's easier to put War into a TV series than it is to put Peace.
Exactly. Especially Aftermath. I think for me, that was the thing that was the most compelling, was the Aftermath. But we need to talk about comics, right?
We do. Actually, can I talk about one other scene? because, to be honest, I'm always a bit hesitant about showing it to students. But if I could show it to students, I would do. But I don't, because it's too tricky to do. But who... I'm trying to think of her name, and it's bugging the hell out of me. But who was the character who went out with Lee off and on through the whole thing, and then went out with, I can't even talk about this because it's stupid. The female character, not Boomer, not... no, we'll talk about it next week.
The one that Apollo eventually marries?
No, she went out with Baltar, and she went out with Lee... Apollo, and then there is one scene where she goes out for like a last meal with him, then goes back to the quarters and shoots herself. And, do you know? Yeah. And that is I'm looking at the wiki and I can't find it. It's ridiculous. But that is
here on the tip of my tongue.
Dwala. I thought that was, to me, one of the most shocking bits of TV that was entirely logical. And I hate bits of TV that are shock with no real reason or build-up or whatever. But when she does what she does, there is just this absolutely brilliant piece of writing and rationale. And that, whenever I think of classic bits of TV or excellent bits of storytelling, that's one of the first things that comes into my mind, is the fact that she is so brilliantly portraying this massive conflict in her mind and does it so well. And I remember watching it at the time and I was absolutely speechless, and yet there was nothing of me saying what on earth happened. It was just there was a perfect lead up that led up to it and yet gave no hint. And I think that's one of my
totally
favorite
logical.
Bits. Yeah, I know. And I there's a couple of times when I teach narrative storytelling, it is one of the things that I would love to show students as an example of perfect narrative storytelling. And if it was a comic or if it's TV or a computer game or whatever, it is a beginning, middle, and end in a minute. And it is so good. But I can't, obviously, because obviously it's a much bigger conversation in that one scene that I would necessarily have with students in such a small part of a unit. But if I was teaching English or drama or something like that, I think that would be right up there as something I would show to anyone just to say, this is immaculate storytelling.
So what's a couple of arcs you do like, now that you're on a narrative storytelling role here?
Can we do Battlestar next week?
Yeah.
I want to come in and...
we could check out the comics as well.
Yeah, we could do a Battlestar comics and things next week. I think that's probably valid, but I think we want to...
some homework for next week.
Yes.
Yep.
But I think that I think
what
we want
series?
To have a word and a report with from Comic-Con in Denver from Jeff.
Yes.
Who was physically out in the real world with real people interacting.
I know. And how are things in the big blue room, Jeff?
It was crazy. It was a really good event. And this was the second year Denver had a Comic-Con. And last year's event was it was big. And it was a lot of fun. And I don't think anyone anticipated this year being so much bigger. It had to have been at least three times as big. And... excuse me. And it was packed. And it was interesting standing in line for 3 hours at a time to get in and listening to people around me complain about how this is so ridiculous and I won't be coming back to this and they need to get organized. And I'm thinking, people, you've clearly never been to San Diego Comic-Con where you can stand in line for days. And the lines are miles long, and you have no idea. But, it was a really cool event. There, I got to meet a lot of fantastic artists and writers, and I got to meet a lot of people in the animated side of the world, and that was cool, too. And then also got to meet with a lot of celebrity talent. So yeah, it was really cool getting to meet with a lot of the artists that were in the Artist Alley area, because when you go there, you get to meet people that if you know what you're looking for, you'll know who to keep watching over time. And like a couple years ago, before we had an actual Denver Comic-Con event, we had a comic event that was linked to the big sci-fi convention. Mm. And when I was there for that, several of the artists that I was chatting with, they went, you need to go meet this guy over here. He's doing this new comic, and we think it's going to be really big, and he's a really cool guy, and it's called Chew.
Oh.
And I'm like, oh, okay. Sure. And I go over and I just sit down and we chit-chatted for like, I don't know, 15, 20 minutes. And I'm like, well, great. It was great to meet you. This stuff looks really cool. Your art's kind of compelling. And I hope this takes off. This is great. And he goes, hey, thank you. And that was that. And then completely forgot about that encounter until we start talking about Chew. And I'm like, oh, man, look at this stuff now. If only I had known. So anyhow, I'm curious to see who out of the people I met this year, a couple years from now, will be talking about as the great artists with the great stories.
So who are you interviewing on the floor for?
For me, and I'm working on some article ideas for Mac Observer. So see, I think there's a story, probably several stories, in the whole transition that we're making from traditional print comics into the digital realm. And so I'm really diving into that to see what I can find. So I really enjoy going to shows where I can talk to people about all this stuff. And excuse me. And I can tell you one group to watch that I think is a big up and comer, and hold on, I have a note here. It's called Kaleidoscope, and It's Kaleidoscope Comics with an X .tumblr.com. That's their website. And what they were showing me was just amazing art. Excuse me. Their first issue hadn't come out yet at Comic-Con, but they had a preview issue ready. And the artwork just totally drew me in. And the quality of the printing was just amazing. And meeting the artist, Dion, was excuse me, a lot of fun. Here's this guy that's just so quiet sitting at the table, so quiet that I didn't even notice him at first because everyone else was talking to me. And when I said, tell me more about the art. Tell me more about the process that went into making this happen. And everyone says, talk to that guy. And they point to the really quiet guy sitting at the table with his face in a notepad. And that would be Dion. And he turned out to be just this very compelling guy. And the artwork that he was making was just, I thought, phenomenal. Matter of fact, he's way better than Dave Gibbons as well.
So actually, sort of wandering around the floor, watching, you know, artists arting in real time, and writers writing away.
Yeah, it was really cool. It was almost like being in a comic book workshop where everyone that's there is someone that is serious in the industry, not just like some kid sitting in his bedroom that has no idea, but calls himself an artist. And to be fair, anyone can sit in their bedroom and create comics, and that's awesome. But if you're doing it professionally, there are some other expectations that you have. So these were people that had the incentive to get out of the bedroom and into the industry for real. And getting to meet writers like Ron Fortier, that was awesome. And the stuff that he's done over the years, I believe a lot of his stuff was for DC, I think. And talking to him about the change in the process for writers over the past 30 years, I mean, it's just fascinating to talk with people like that. And then, of course, there's always the cosplay. And this year, I saw stuff that I hadn't seen before. And it was people in wheelchairs coming up with just absolutely brilliant costumes that incorporated their pictures.
I saw that picture. I was checking out some of the comic cosplayers.
Yeah, like the
from Denver. And that I saw that somewhere, and I thought I love that. I thought it was really brilliant.
Yeah, it was absolutely brilliant. And there was another woman roaming around, and I didn't get her picture because I couldn't get through the crowd to where she was. But she was a speed racer, and so she had turned her wheelchair into the car.
Cool. Yeah.
And I think it was last year at Starfest, I saw a girl in a wheelchair as Davros.
Oh my God.
You know, and so just absolutely brilliant. So that was really cool to get to see all of that. And Denver Comic Con is set up to be a family event. So they have this whole center area in the expo floor that's activities for kids. Because it's the nice. The whole event is done in conjunction with Comic Book Classroom, which is an organization that started here in Denver that uses comic books as a way to teach kids art and reading and storytelling skills. And so the group goes in and helps out in schools, and they do these special programs. So that group was there, and they were doing all these kids' activities, and so you're seeing a lot of stuff that was happening in association with that as well. So it was really cool because of that. Instead of seeing just a bunch of people that were there alone or with a friend, you're seeing families there. So mom and dad with the kids,
yeah,
and that was just really, really cool to see.
Yeah, I mean, cosplay is absolutely my favorite part of a Comic-Con, and I love it. And the funny thing about it is, you know, comics and sci-fi and geek culture gets such a bad rap. But I took my daughter and my niece and 20 students to MCM Comic-Con last year, and they had a whale of a time, and there was no point at any point did I ever feel that my daughter wasn't... And she, my daughter cosplayed when she went. And there was no point where she'd say to me, oh, can I go over there and come back in an hour's time? I was like, yeah, go for it. That's fine, because it felt like it's really fabulous, friendly, lovely atmosphere. And the cosplayers were all brilliant with each other and chatting to each other. And then chatting to anyone who'd come up and talk to them. And I thought it's absolutely fabulous. And this year we were doing a number of events at the college with tablet art. And the one that we couldn't fit in because of deadlines with the kids and staffing and stuff like that was MCM Comics Expo. And I was so utterly disappointed to not be able to go, because we were going to take easels and tablets and draw the cosplayers. And I was looking forward to that.
Well, like, that would have been so
you
cool.
You wouldn't believe. And we're hoping to do it again in October, if they're not really, really grumpy of us for having to pull out, which we felt awful about doing. But when I went to MCM last year, the cosplayers were not just a highlight of the Comics Expo, but just of my year. They were brilliant, and they were lovely and fabulous, and you'd chat. And it was a party atmosphere, and I absolutely adored it.
Yeah, it's so cool. And it adds, I think, a really special touch to conventions, because you see these people that are pouring their heart and souls into creating these costumes, and there's a passion to what they're doing because they love the shows or the comics or the movies that the characters come from. And it's so cool to see how they bring the spirit of that show or that character to life through the costume they make. And of course, most people that are cosplaying will also play up the character as well. So it's not just like some guy walking around with a Superman shirt on, but people walking around acting as if they're Superman or Wonder Woman or the Doctor from Doctor Who or whoever.
I must say, there aren't that many other areas of people's interest where, I mean, you go to a comic con or a sci-fi con or something like that, and you're interested in this, in the genre and what's going on there. You might not be able to draw and be a professional artist, or you might not be a writer, you might not be in the industry, but it's one way that you can really, you can be part of the whole event yourself. Whatever skills you've got, you can bring those to your costume, and you can come in and you can actually, by being in costume, you're actually adding to the event by being there. You're not just consuming. It's a really nice thing, and there's not many other areas of sort of life where you can get involved like that.
Yeah, it's really cool. And when you see how the actors that are at shows like this react to people that are cosplaying a character they played, I mean, it's really cool. As an example, I spent quite a while just chit-chatting with Daphne Ashbrook, who played the companion for the Eighth Doctor in the Doctor Who made-for-TV movie that was done in the United States back in the 90s. And just to watch how gracious she was and genuinely excited to see people cosplaying Doctor Who. And a couple guys came by in Ghostbusters outfits where they had made their own proton packs with animated lights and stuff. And I mean, they were movie quality props these guys had made. Uh-huh. And she goes, wait, I need you guys to pose so she could take a photograph. And she wasn't doing it just to patronize these guys. She thought that their costumes were so cool. She really wanted to take a photo home with her.
Excellent.
Yeah.
I think one of my most pleasing uber geek moments, you probably won't, it won't mean a lot to you, but Paul will probably know, is that we have a radio station here in the UK, Radio 2, which is a middle of the road sort of middle aged listening thing. And they have a middle of the day show, which is a talkish show with music by a presenter called Jeremy Vine. And it's a bit bland, and it's a bit blah blah blah. And anyway,
I know who Jeremy Vine is.
They were doing a talk about something or other, and he happened to mention Ghostbusters and dropped it into the thing. And he said about the costumes and things. And he said, "Oh, of course, the coolest thing is these things with these photon packs." And I just sat at my desk and I thought,
and you're like, no. "Oh my god!"
So I phoned in and it was like, Jeremy Vine live. And I said, he's always got something to add. And I said, yes, Jeremy, I think a photon pack would be a torch.
Huh. Yes, it would.
They're like, you can see that. Like,
and it's okay to cross the streams with a photon pack.
It is, yes. And there's like silence on the other. It's like, okay. And my wife is into the radio going, you moron.
Well, in your defense, you do know the difference between a photon pack and a proton pack.
I do, and there is no other defense. It
but
has
you'll
to be
never
said.
Be on BBC Radio 2. You're on the list now.
No, I have, as we say, shot my load in one. So
yeah, but what a way to do it.
Yeah. So. Oh, dear. So all in all, I mean, next year, bigger, better, I guess.
Yes, I'm guessing, and I have no numbers to go by. I'm just basing this on the lines, the crowds, the amount of floor space that was taken up. I'm going to guess there's about 50,000 people at this event, which is insane for a second year convention. Hmm. And my guess is that next year will be bigger, and I will definitely be back again next year, and I'll be talking with more artists and doing more interviews and just having a great time.
Jeff, can I ask you a question about it?
Yes.
I had a look at the guest list, and I couldn't tell because I didn't recognize any of the names. When I was at MCM and when I was at the Gadget Show, in both of them, some of the guys that had the most star status with the crowds were the YouTubers and the guys that have YouTube channels. Did you see that there at all, or was that more of a maybe a UK thing?
Maybe that's more of a UK thing, but I wasn't watching for that specifically. The people that were there that had the big star status that weren't actually like big name celebrities, like, you know, like William Shatner and Peter Mayhew and Colin Baker. Those people, they did have web presence though. And for a lot of them, it was their own website, not necessarily YouTube. So how about if I meet you halfway on that and say that an internet presence of some sort did have a significant role in who was seen as a celebrity at the event?
Well, mainly what I was thinking about was, again, it's more of a personal thing, but I noticed it when we went to the Gadget Show in April. I can't remember the name of it, but there was a guy who did YouTube videos of Call of Duty walkthroughs, or some sort of computer game YouTube channel guy. And literally all of the students said to me, we don't mind working on the stand that we're going to be running, but we all want the time off to go and see this guy when he does his talk. I thought, oh, okay, that's great. Thanks a lot. So we had to work out who didn't want to go and see him the most, and then they stayed. But everyone wanted to see him. And when we were at MCM, my daughter and my wife both watched Once Upon a Time. Mm-hmm. And there were a couple of actors and writers and producers from that at MCM. And I said to my daughter, look, come over. All these shows, I'm always working like mad because I've got students all over the place and you're worrying about the devices and students and a poster falling off the stand or something. But I said, look, I thought I've got to do something with my daughter because I'm working, but I want her to enjoy something here. So I took her over and I said, do you want to... The Once Upon a Time guys are over here, and I'm sure they'll let me take you through, have a quick photo and come out if you want, because we're working really hard on the stand. And she said, no, it's okay, don't worry, I want to see them, and I'm happy to see them over a distance, but I was more excited to see, and I can't remember the names, Jack and Dean or something, who do a YouTube channel where their YouTube films get a million hits, and that was more exciting to her than seeing the actors from Once Upon a Time.
You know, that doesn't surprise me. With the way people were acting at Comic-Con, the way I've seen people act at Comic-Con last year at Starfest, I think that the internet shows seem to be more relatable and more approachable to a lot of people, and so they get more excited when they get to see those people in person. And if you take it to the extreme, you have shows like The Guild, and you know, Felicia Day, her fame, while she was a professional actress before she started doing The Guild, people really know her for that. And and she had a panel, a guild panel. So it was her, Sandeep, and Aaron Gray, and I forgot who else.
Not anyhow. Actual Aaron Gray.
Yes, actual really Aaron Gray. And so they did this guild panel, and people had to line up almost 2 hours in advance to get into it. And the room that they were in seated 1,200 people, and there were probably 1,500 people in the room. I'm sure the fire marshal wasn't pleased with that. Hmm. And that's the kind of reaction I am seeing to internet-based entertainment, I'll call it. And of course, with Felicia Day, it goes to the extreme. But I'm seeing a lot of interest in what's going on the internet. And
I think interaction level. Like, honestly, I think it's because the guys that make the YouTube videos are replying to people in the comments about the video.
Yeah.
Yeah, and my daughter goes down. You know, we're outside London about 2 hours on the train, and she goes to London with her friend to see YouTubers. You know, they'll park off in Soho Square or Hyde Park, and she goes down with her friend, and there's a queue, and at the end of this queue of girls, it's all girls, and they're all sort of 16-year-old girls, and at the head of this queue is a 17, 18-year-old boy with spectacles on. And I'm thinking, when I was at school, this would never happen. This guy is a dyed-in-the-wool geek. And he has a queue of 70 or 80 teenage girls queuing up to talk to him.
You know, can you imagine how popular we all would have been if we'd had YouTube when we were in high school?
Oh, my goodness.
I know.
Do you know how much easier high school would have been? Because I grew up in the wilderness. So for me, it was very... So Kelly, just you. And it would have been so nice when I was 15, 16, 17 to know I wasn't the only girl that still liked Star Wars and wasn't embarrassed to admit it. I wasn't the only girl that wasn't interested in wearing a dress every day. I wasn't the only girl who anything ever. Hmm. It would have been so nice to have had the opportunity to know that, because it would have made high school so much better.
We had years ago, when I had my own company, we had this young girl, and she was a designer, and she was very good, very talented, really attractive, beautiful, blah, blah, blah. And we used to sort of take the mickey out of her because she was obviously attractive. But she was also a damn fine designer, which is why she was working for us. And we said to her, you know what? You're the girl, one of those girls, that when we were at school, we were sitting under the stairs at break and lunchtime playing Dungeons and Dragons. And you would walk past the stairs or up the stairs and you didn't even know we existed. And she looked at us quizzically and went, I don't think we had anyone like that at school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, see, there you go.
Yes, but now, of course, there'd be a queue of girls in the footwell going, oh, when are you uploading your next YouTube? Can I be on it? Can we? So, yes, I think it's going to be a geek of our age needs to invent the time machine and take YouTube back to when.
But, you know, where we are today with the technology allowing us to do shows like this, we've been empowered in a way that that wasn't just impossible back when we were all in high school. And it's such a change in the way we can create media that I have a niece that one day asked, Uncle Jeffy, what do you do for a job? And I told her that I write about technology, I write about Apple, I go on to podcasts and I talk about technology and comics and movies and books and iPhones. And she goes, wait, you get paid to talk about stuff you like? And I stopped and thought, yes, I do. She's like, that's crazy. No one's supposed to like their job, because of course that's what she sees from her parents. But it totally changed her perspective on media, because now to her, media is a field that anyone can get into, and actually I have seen in her that she is looking more towards the internet for entertainment, meaning YouTube shows and podcasts and things like that, than television.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
And you know why? Because you can get all the stuff from YouTube on an iPad or on an iPod Touch. And most TV programs aren't quite that way yet.
Yeah. Yeah.
Plus, you also can create shows for a very targeted market. Like, for example, the comic show. This can't run on NBC because right. this is too focused. And I think a lot of kids are looking for targeted entertainment as opposed to the homogenized lowest common denominator content that you have on television.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. I think it's just about, you know, the the market, the whole the total market might remain the same, but the level of interest in each individual niche is much higher now. And I think you get these niche shows get much greater audience involvement than they would have done before, when the show was like, you know, Starsky and Hutch, which you just enjoyed. Now, you know, that you get the community and the fan base and the interaction and stuff, which, you know, right down to the granular level at YouTube. It's fantastic. But Paul's right, who's tweeting me anything, saying I did get a threat from another of the network's podcasters if we turned into the media show again, that he would kneecap me. So I will be limping next week.
Well, Alex, he's a character.
How about if I bring it back around to comics by saying, and that was one of the biggest things that I saw at Comic-Con. It was the accessibility and the availability of the artists and the ease of access to the highly focused stories and artists and comics. And that's one thing that I saw people really gravitating towards, especially kids and teenagers. They were going to where all the independent artists were to find the comics that those people were making. And in a lot of cases, to find the artists and writers that they have been reading to tell them what fans they are. So they weren't looking for the big names that are writing for Marvel and DC and Dark Horse and all of the big names that we know. They were looking for the indie artists and the indie writers.
And I think that Kelly's proved it as well as earlier when she said, you know, if you manage to corner Mark Miller at a Comic-Con, there's no way he's going to write you into a script. So.
Right.
Or at least not in a way that Kelly wants.
No, that would be...
Right, and Dave Gibbons isn't going to draw you into a script.
No.
And if he does...
Well, not that you'd be recognizable.
Not in the way you like.
Not in the way you'd want, no. So I think what we're going to have to do is skip the comic readers and do that next week, because I know that Jeff's got an appointment, and we've got some picks to fit in, just as Kelly's vanished. So hopefully she'll come back in time to give us her pick. So what we'll do is we'll just go with... Paul, find out if you've got anything to bring to the table that we're all going to rush off and buy and consume and learn from this week.
Well, funnily enough, Kelly started me, well, didn't start it off, but we started talking about Dave McKean, and I love Dave McKean. And then Kelly picked up a Sandman cover and said she likes this artist. Well, of course, the artist who did all the Sandman covers was Dave McKean. And he's currently finishing off so Dave McKean is a real artisty artist, and he does exhibitions of his artwork. And the exhibition is a thematic comic, often. And you will walk in the front door of the exhibition and become involved in a comic, which is comic pages on the walls, but also sculptures or the way that light moves around the room or whatever. So the most recent one that he did was an exhibition called The Blue Tree, which is about the way that a tree grows in emotion and grows in the world of these characters. And you walk into...
Dog.
Yep, I saw him. You did try. So anyway, you walk into this exhibition, and when you get to the culmination of the exhibition, there is a sculpture of a blue tree in the middle of this exhibition hall. Now, I've no idea how he's going to do it, but he's collecting all these exhibitions that he's done and turn them into a comic that you can buy, or a graphic novel. Now, the first one that he released about a year ago was called Pictures That Tick, or actually, it was released much longer ago, but you couldn't buy it. And Dark Horse reprinted it about a year ago. And Pictures That Tick is artistically fabulous on every single page, and I absolutely adore it. And to know that this year there's Pictures That Tick 2 coming out, or it should be called Pictures That Tick Tock, but whatever. That's coming out. But also, there's another book by Dave McKean called, or I don't know what it's called, but he did the Heston Blumenthal book, The Fat Duck Cookbook, although you can typo that on a keyboard really badly and Google something you really don't want.
We'll let you down.
Yeah, it will not help you. But
fact, depending on your taste, it might.
He's been well, yeah, but not anything I want to cook. And right. He's working on a sequel of that at the moment, and that should be coming out this year as well. So there are two glorious Dave McKean books coming out in December, hopefully. But Pictures That Tick, you can get it from Dark Horse. It is fabulous, and but not only that, but Dave McKean is a very talented writer as well. The stories are great, but the artwork is just. The pinnacle of comic art to me.
Excellent, and it does sound intriguing. It's very multimedia there, I guess, and well, multi everything.
Yeah, give him free reign. He's with the space and whatever. He did another one in an exhibition hall in Battersea Park called The Rut, and it was all about an attack by school kids on one of their schoolmates who was gay. And they corner him in a park and beat him up. And it's about... The exhibition was about the four different viewpoints. The guy that instigated the attack, the person who was attacked, the person who was a witness to the attack, and I can't remember who the fourth person was because it was about 2 years ago that I saw the exhibition. But you walked through the exhibition through different ways and saw the story through different viewpoints, but still came to the middle. And it's he has got a brain. Dave McKean's brain is... I would love to see the world from it. From that point.
Excellent. And Jeff.
All right, so I'm sticking with my indie theme this week. So my pick is a web-based comic called Castle What's Its Name. And it's written and drawn by an artist named Kira Woodmansey. And this isn't a kid's comic. It's definitely it definitely has a lot of adult themes in it, but it's kind of a fantasy comic where you have anthropomorphized animals and fantasy castle scenes, but it's a really fun storyline, and I really enjoy Kira's artwork as well, and the great thing is you can get at it online, so you can check it out whenever you want. And that one is castlewhatsitsname.com. And as it turns out, Kira also happens to be a Colorado-based artist and writer.
Interesting. So. I'm looking at it now. It's, yeah.
I'm looking now. Yeah.
Quite. There's some sort of Disney-esque vibe going on there, isn't there?
Yes, and. The clever part to me for that kind of Disney-ish feel that you get some of the artwork is that when you first look at it, you're thinking, oh, okay, these are going to be like kids-level stories or themes that might be appropriate for tweens and really young teens. But then when you're actually reading it, no. it's adult themes, which is not to say this is porn, because it's not. But it's themes and ideas that are more appropriate for adults to look at and think about than 12-year-olds.
Right. Yeah. Okie doke. And there's still no Kelly, which is she's a vanished off our Skype tree.
You know, we could try and do her pick for her.
We could do her pick for her.
Kelly picks the best of Dave Gibbons' anthology.
Yes, she does. Let's all tell her that.
Yes.
When you will.
So actually, her pick. I've had like three people in the last week mention Sabretooth Vampire, and I need to check this out. So I guess now I really need to, because Kelly's in on it too. So all I know about it is that it's exactly what it sounds like. It's a vampire. It's a sabretooth vampire.
So it is. I'm looking at it now. Yes, very. It's very. Yes. Oh, my word. Skype doesn't like holding up over an hour, does it?
Drawing.
why not? And there's a saber-toothed vampire, and with Telltale snicked, his fangs shoot out like 3 feet from his face.
Cool. Yeah, and no, I like that.
I love it. The art's really good on that. Yes, that's really sweet.
Really fun looking.
I'm going to round off, because once again Skype has decided that 51 minutes of recording is about its nadir. In some ways, mine's a book, definitely a graphic novel, probably slightly akin, if it's akin to anything, to Art Spiegelman's Mouse. And it's a book called Persepolis by an Iranian woman called Marjane Satrapi. And it's an excellent book. It's kind of the antithesis of last week's. Kelly liked her pick because it had a woman character that wasn't necessarily a woman, and this is a woman character who could only be a woman, because it's basically the story of a 13-year-old girl growing up in pre-revolutionary Iran and then moving to Europe, Western Europe, and discovering that Western Europe isn't all it's cracked up to be. Before returning,
I have heard about this before, and it sounds fascinating.
It is. It's a really, really good a glimpse into growing up in a totally alien culture, and the stresses and strains. And it's a warts and all book. She's a horribly precocious 13-year-old child, but what really saves the narrative is that she knows she's a horribly precocious 13-year-old child, and she writes that so well. The artwork is lovely, simple, black and white. Normally, I'm all over the art, and the plot kind of comes along later. But this is exactly the opposite. It's such a well written story, and it's such a good character piece that follows her right down to the depths where she ends up as a alcohol, cigarette, and drug addicted 19-year-old selling drugs on the streets of Paris before heading back to Iran to rediscover religion. An excellent, excellent book. Yes. Ah, there's Kelly. Are you back, Kelly?
Maybe.
Hooray! We did do your pick for you. Dave Gibbons is very pleased.
Yeah, I think he's sending you a bouquet. It's poorly drawn, but it's a really nice bouquet.
He said he's going to draw you into a comic, but unfortunately you're going to look like Alan Moore.
Well, I'm from Portland, so people will just assume that's accurate.
So if you've got... Jeff did your vampire werewolf pick for you, but if you want to add anything...
I do. This is another, like La Brujeria, this is another one where I know the creator. And here's the thing about Sabretooth Vampire, is that Sabretooth Vampire is a one-note joke.
But it's a good
one.
I
mean, it is. Mike Russell... that draws it, Mike Russell, I think he's hilarious, and he's of a particular humor type that really entertains me. So, I doubt it's for everybody. I don't know if it was part of the show or if it was, extended cut from before, but every once in a while, he's an artist that gets invited by the Portland Opera to come and do drawings during their dress rehearsal, so people go and do like sketches of what's happening on stage. And he's done a couple of those and they're pretty good. And Dark Horse Presents actually featured Sabretooth Vampire in an issue whose number escapes me at the moment. But Sabretooth Vampire is just a vampire with giant saber teeth. And when I say giant saber teeth, I mean they're approximately double or triple the height of the actual Sabretooth Vampire. And there's the joke. That's it. That's the whole thing. And... it is hilarious, and he's done a couple of issues of them, and I'm always amused by what the punchline ends up being in each of them, and I think he's called the volumes something like, the Sabretooth Vampire Rides Again or something like that, and it's always really entertaining to see, for me, to see what they end up being, and I'm always entertained by... what's the story going to be? Because a lot of times there's an adventure. It's not just two panels, and that's the joke. So it's always funny to me what that ends up being. So I'm very amused by it. Mike Russell is a very amusing fellow. He did the reason I have sworn him my eternal allegiance is not only because the art's better than Dave Gibbons' art, but also because
ages ago, he was sitting in a waiting room and took requests for sketches on Twitter. He said, what do you guys want me to draw? And I said, I want a James Bond garden gnome, and he drew it, and it's awesome.
That's fantastic.
And he published it, so you can go, like, if you go Google James Bond garden gnome, now I'm totally going to skew his site results, which is awesome. And also, he drew it, and it was really cool. And so I like his style. He did some other stuff that's pretty funny. I think one of the other requests in that same post where he said I got to draw some stuff was Spock with boobs, which was a good one. And there were, like, mustaches on unicycles, I think, was another. It was pretty fab. So really random stuff, but he's great. I love him, and Sabretooth Vampire is always entertaining to me. So there's my pick.
Awesome. Excellent, and completely out of left field there. It's lovely. I love it. It's just simple little things going on. I'm just watching the one of him wheeling down the hill and hitting the railway track. Just that like,
is awesome.
Hiss, Duke, Fap.
Yeah.
Yes. Excellent. So, just to round off, I think we're bang on time for Jeff's next appointment. So, whereabouts can we find everyone?
You can find me at, if you go to kercal.co.uk, kercal.co.uk, you can get the Flickr and the YouTube and all the stuff from there.
Cool. Jeff?
All right. For those of you that don't know me, I'm Jeff Gamet, managing editor of Mac Observer. So you can find me at macobserver.com. You can find me on Twitter and app.net. I'm Jay Gamet, both places. I also do The Big Show, Apple Contacts Machine. We have Communicators and a bunch of other podcasts.
And sleep sometimes?
Rarely. And go check out Fresh Brewed Tales. That's my blog where I write about all the crazy stuff that I see in coffee shops.
Fantastic. Will do. And Kelly, who's gone again, just after giving us her pick. Oh, you're
I'm
back.
Gone?
Are you here? Are you back? And Kelly's at...
I may or may not be here. When I am here, you can find me on Twitter and app.net as Verso. You can also find me hosting the Tua Talkcast and over at tuaw.com. And you can occasionally find me writing there as well or guesting in a variety of other places like on this very network and on Angry Mac Bastards.
Sweet. And myself... You can find me also on this network on the Mac Show every Friday, apart from this Friday, because I'm going to London to see a concert because I'm a grown-up adult. So, yes, we're going to see Rodriguez, which is a fascinating story all by itself, but brilliant. So I'll be missing next Friday. And you can find me on the Twitters at Dr. Happy Mac, and you can find me in the real world at Dr. Happy Mac, courtesy of Google as well. So that's, I believe, where we're at. We didn't manage to fit in e-comics. Which I think probably we'll try and do next week. Hopefully we can try and kick Skype back into gear again. I'm going to shift over. In a week or so, I shall have a fibre line into the office, so I think that might carry some more bandwidth in. Because that's been playing merry hell with Kelly all afternoon, I think. She's been dipping in.
Oh, I don't think it's you. My entire computer's off right now. Something has caused my network to come off the internet.
So... and I think before we go again, Ewan would be ever so grateful if we mentioned the God-giving sponsors of UK2.
Yes.
.net. What do they do? They do good.
Everything.
Everything. Yes. Domain hosting, domain registration, access to full DNS services, web hosting, website building. They've got this kind of one-stop build your own website solution going on, which is all great if you're a consumer and you're buying stuff. If you're Ewan's British Tech Network and you're consuming bandwidth, they're also gorgeous because they just stump it up, and they've been supporting Ewan's shows for a good long time and hopefully into the future. So uk2.net, top of the
they'll do everything but bring you curry.
They will, yes. They won't bring you curry, will you? I have had everything delivered to my table this evening. My curry's gone cold. I've been nibbling at it. It's gone cold, but I'm going to go off and eat it now. And Jeff will be joining you on the big show in probably about 30 to 40 seconds' time.
Probably.
So I hope we didn't talk you out, and we'll be back, I guess, for episode 4, yet to be titled.
Indeed.
But we're not going to go with The Phantom Menace, because that's a bad episode 4 title to be running with. So, thank you very much, Jeff and Kelly and Paul. Goodbye!